It's Michael Dean. I'm here from the Freedom Fiends. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good.
All right. Well, yeah, obviously you guys know Voluntary Virtues Radio. It's good to have Michael Dean on the show.
And I'm honored.
Michael, yeah. Michael Dean is, he's only one half of the Freedom Fiends, although a pretty big chunk of it. And the Freedom Fiends, for those who don't know, is Michael Dean and Nima Vedati.
We're both a pretty big chunk of it. Both halves. Yeah. Both halves are about three quarters of the show.
Yeah, Nima, don't get mad at me. I'm sorry. But it is a really feisty radio show. It's a fun, feisty radio show about market anarchy, the digital police state, self-defense, real money, activism, do-it-yourself media, what else, pets and rock and roll. I mean, these guys talk about everything in a really positive manner, I think. You guys can find out more of their content over at freedomfiends.com. But Michael Dean himself directed the documentary film Do It Yourself or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist. He also did Hubert Selby Jr., which is It'll Be Better Tomorrow, narrated by Robert Downey Jr., and Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, with Nima V. And Michael was a featured speaker over at the New Media Expo, and he's the author of the how-to books, $30 Film School, and A User's Manual for the Human Experience. Michael sang and played bass, hey, I play a little guitar myself, in the post-punk band Bomb Warner Brothers. He writes for Talkers Magazine, and Michael lives in a windowless bunker at an undisclosed location in the rural Mountain West in the occupied states of America.
That's me.
Michael, it's so glad. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I want to point out Lou Reed died yesterday, and I'm really sad about that. I don't know, sad. I mean, he was 71. You know, like I've read articles where they're like, yeah, and this is why you shouldn't die. You shouldn't do drugs. You'll die of liver failure. And I'm like, you shouldn't do drugs because you'll die at age 71. Loved the world over, I guess is what some people are saying.
But, like, it's anybody else's business, right?
Yeah, but Lou Reed is in my documentary. We have an interview with him in my documentary, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow. If people want to go check that out, it's a very interesting interview. He was a big fan of Selby's.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Yeah, it was obviously a sad loss. A lot of people loved him and his work, and I was definitely another one of those people.
Yeah.
But, hey, listen, Mike, for those who don't know
– Michael. My friends call me Michael. Do you go by Michael or Mike?
I go by Mike. It really doesn't matter to me, but most of my family has called me Mike throughout my whole life, so I kind of get used to that. But there's so many Michaels out there, I think that's probably why, because usually the Michaels are called Michael, and I guess Mike was just kind of an off-tangent that was less used, at least back in the 80s and 90s. But anyway, yeah, most people call me Mike. But for my listeners who really don't know your background, because I have a whole other sect, I'm sure a lot of them have heard your work before. But for those who don't, I always like to ask people who come on my show for the first time, how was your childhood? What kind of environment were your parents political or apolitical? Did you go to public school, private school, homeschooled, unschooled? Obviously, I know what you were. But for those who don't, can you give us a little bit of background on how you got to where you are today?
That's an interesting question, and I'm really happy to answer it. The only person that's ever asked me that was Stefan Molyneux when I interviewed him, and I ended up getting in an argument with him because he was trying to psychoanalyze me rather than just asking a question.
But this is not a psychoanalyst.
Yeah, because everything with Stefan Molyneux, he's a great guy, but he has a couple faults, and one I think is that like most fans of Freud, he takes everything back to, you must have had a bad childhood. Let's see. Okay, my childhood, I grew up in upstate New York near Lake Erie. My parents were pretty old when they had me. I was a happy accident. I had two sisters in high school and a brother in college when I was born. My dad was 43 and my mother was 40 when I was born, but I was raised in love. And, you know, never beaten, anything like that. I was kind of a latchkey kid. Both of my parents had a really strong work ethic and were both self-employed, working 80 hours a week, making what they'd worked 40 hours a week for someone else, which is a big inspiration for me. I haven't had a job in 10 years. And, you know, I'm happily married and live out in the sticks and I don't want to say I own a house. I own a mortgage, but I'm not renting anymore. And I do all of my work in my pajamas with a cat on my lap at home. So that's because my parents were workaholics and I was kind of a latchkey kid. So I was home a lot alone. I kind of, went to the library to educate myself a lot. The library was two blocks down the street. And after school, my parents wouldn't be home for several hours. So I'd just go down to the library and learn. My parents were both lifelong Republicans. My dad had opinions about it. My mother just kind of did it quietly. They were both raised on farms. My mother in Nebraska and my dad in upstate New York. And they met at a family reunion, which makes me sound like a crazy inbred person. They're not related. They were related by someone else's marriage, and they met at a family reunion. So let's see. I was a really smart kid, tested off the charts on everything, but challenged the teachers a lot from a really young age, especially when they were wrong and I was right, and got in trouble for it. If you go on the Freedom Fiends website and click on bios, on my bio, I have some scans of some report cards. After my mother died, my sister sent me a box of my stuff that my mother had in the attic, and I scanned some of the report cards, and they're, you know, from grade like 5 through 11 or 12, they're all at two different schools. The report cards are all like, Michael is the smartest kid in the class, but he's problematic and distracts the other kids, and he doesn't seem willing to listen. Which, you know, I just say it shows that I was an anarchist and didn't like authority figures, especially when they were wrong from a very young age. It's kind of in my blood.
So you questioned the authority of the teachers and everything they were teaching. So you saw right through the revisionist history that they were trying to put
down. I don't know. I didn't really have the awakening of becoming a libertarian until about 8 years ago. Basically, in California, soon after I got married, somebody tried to break into our house while we were there. And I was 41 years old. Like I had a pretty late conversion, but it was very quick. It was like someone tried to break in our house while we were there. I said the next day, honey, we're buying a shotgun. She said, I don't think that's a good idea. Having a gun is saying that the world is a bad place. And I said, sometimes the world is a bad place and I love you. So let's get a shotgun. And unlike most males in California, I did something that my wife told me not to. I was just like, I'm getting a shotgun. I'm going to keep it here. And we got it. We took it to a range, took some lessons, took some safety courses. She fired the shotgun and we left the range. And she like, I like guns. I want to get more. So we got more. And I started reading. I bought a gun book on Amazon, a book about gun laws in California. And it said, people who bought this book also bought You and the Police by Boston Tea Party. So I ordered that book. It's a short book. It's very influential on the cop blocking movement. Everyone should read it. It's You and the Police. It predates cop block, but it's basically outlines cop blocking and knowing your rights. And I basically became a libertarian, you know, went from being like a lazy Democrat to being a hardcore libertarian in one like 2 hour sitting reading that book.
Wow.
And that book, like, we had bought handguns by then, and we were really pissed off that we couldn't leave the house in California legally and have our guns in the car or on our person. And in this book, You and the Police, he mentioned something in passing about open carry. You know, if you're open carrying in a state where it's legal, you can blow in the police stop you. And I'm like, open carry? What the hell is that? I've never heard of that. And I looked it up, and I was like, you know, this was like midnight and I spent the night reading and I woke my wife up. She was supposed to be up at like 7 to get ready for work. And I woke her up at 6 and said, honey, we're moving to Wyoming. And she said, huh, what? And 9 months later, we bought a house we came here and rented a house for a year and then ended up buying it. So like 9 months later, you know, it just happened really quickly. And a lot of my education happened during that time. And in that 9 months, you know, probably for about a year and a half, I was ultra minarchist, and then finally just had that moment. They say it's like, why is it so hard for people to go from status, or it's so easy for people to go from status to minarchist, but you know that's like a 1,000-mile journey and you can do that in one night, and it takes people years sometimes to go that last mile from minarchist to anarcho-capitalist or anarchist. And it took me a year and a half. It basically took me meeting Nima Vedati, and he was living in Casper, Wyoming at the time, and he'd done this rap song called I Own Me, and I heard it and I wrote to him on MySpace. This is how long ago this was. I wrote to him on his MySpace account, and that was the only way to get in touch with him. And I thought he lived in Texas because he was listed on MySpace as living in Texas. And I found out he lived about 12 blocks from me. And I'm like,
wow.
Hey, man, come over for dinner. We're having buffalo chili. And we were. My wife was cooking buffalo chili. And, you know, being a starving bachelor, like working a low paying job, he was like, free meal? Yeah, I'm there. And he came over and we, you know, not that he looks for a free lunch, but like he was working his butt off and starving just because he was working in television. He was like the guy on the news giving the news on ABC when I turned on the TV at night here. But they don't pay entry level people that very much because it's so competitive and so many people want to do it. So he came over for dinner and we talked to him about guns and we showed him all our guns. And he was like many libertarians, one of those people who absolutely believes in the right to keep and bear arms, but didn't keep or bear any. And a few days later, I took him out shooting and I taught him to shoot. And he was a really good student. Like he was within about seven times of going out shooting with me. He was a better shot than me, and I'd been shooting for several years and I'd taken like Appleseed courses and things like that. Like the seventh time we went out shooting in one shot, and we filmed this for the movie. It opens the Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom movie we made. In one shot, he hit a dinner plate at 380 yards with an antique rifle from World War II that had no scope on it. I can do that now, like years later, but I couldn't do that then. It took, you know, like he was that quick of a study, and I guess I was that good of a teacher. And, you know, I taught him about guns, and he taught me that anarchy is more, you know, peaceful anarchy is far more ethical than, minarchy. And that was what really did it for me. But on our show, we always try to sell it from two angles. We try to sell everything that's good, or preach everything that's good, or teach everything that's good from the ethical angle, but also for people who aren't willing to accept that yet, we teach it from the tactical angle. You know, like, well, voting and democracy and trying for small government through the system, I mean, there's been 200 and some years of that, and look where it's got us. It's got us right to more government. So I always approach things on the ethical issue first, but then immediately follow it with the will this work in your life and how's this working for you. And basically that comes for me from being in AA. I've been sober for almost 20 years. I was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And there's not really an ethical issue in AA. The ethical issue is if you've done harm to people, make amends to them. But the real thing is like when someone is in their cups, in their depth, near their depth with drugs or alcohol, you know, someone who's sober, who they come to for help, doesn't preach down to them. They don't say you're a bad person like judges and ex-spouses and family who aren't alcoholics have done to them. They look across the table at them eye to eye as a peer and say, I'm like you. If I was like you, I'll be like you again if I drink. Let me ask you this. You know, you've tried to change everything and maneuver this and maneuver that, and you've ended up, you know, a penniless drug addict. Do you think you can change it? You know, so you approach it on the tactical level. If you approach it on the tactical level, it's a lot more useful than if you just beat people over the head with voting is aggression. Voting is aggression, but most people can't get that. But they can totally get if you say, you know, if you keep feeding this beast with voting, it's only going to get worse. If you vote for lesser of two evils, you're going to get evil. So that's kind of my life story and my approach to liberty.
You know, my outtake on this is kind of bringing a balance to both sides. Some people like the Friedmans, the David Friedmans, only really want to focus on the economics.
Yeah.
And you'll hear Stefan Molyneux really hit on the praxeological and non-aggression route, right? I mean, he even says we have to argue from first axioms. I like to take the middle ground. Maybe I have to set the tone, in my opinion at least, for a little bit more praxeological base. But if you don't have that economic understanding, the consequentialist subjective argument from the voluntarist perspective, then you know the people really can't see how it's going to improve their lives, right? So I do agree with David and Friedman on that, but I think we have to take it from a balance, and I think that's what you basically just hit on right there. So
I don't know what praxeological is, and people have explained it to me, and it's a big 25-cent word, and I don't know, man. The average voter that's ruining my life isn't going to know what the word praxis is, even if I figure it out and explain it to him. So I don't use that kind of big words with people. The only thing I know what praxis is there was a band called Praxis that had the guy that engineered produced my record Bomb. I was in a band called Bomb, and we're on Warner Brothers, and Bill Laswell was the producer on that Warner Brothers record, and he was in a band called Praxis, but I don't think he's a libertarian. I don't even know what praxis means. So, yeah, man, I want to speak to everybody, and I'm not complaining about people using those kind of words, but for my tactic of like going out one man speaking to another first century Christianity wise, and I'm not a Christian, but I like the idea of like speaking one person to another. And when I'm doing a radio show or I'm doing a podcast, even if there's thousands of people listening to it, I picture I'm talking to one person. And that's kind of the beauty of talk media. And it's why I've concentrated on it, even though I'm a filmmaker and a musician. Talk media, talk radio and podcasting are this great medium that feels like one person talking to another. I also want to give a shout out. I sent you an email today, Mike. It's a 30-second commercial I made for the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I'm encouraging people for the month of November who are podcasters or radio hosts to put it in their shows. And if you put this in your show today and put it up today or tomorrow, you're literally going to be the first person that gets to play this ad that hundreds of people in like major radio stations and syndicates are going to be playing for the month of November. I have an article coming out in Talkers Magazine tomorrow or the next day. And the EFF are a nonprofit legal fund that has been fighting government intrusion going back to 1990. They've sued the NSA. They've sued patent trolls. Literally, if it weren't for the EFF, the internet would be illegal. So I'm encouraging all people who produce media to download this ad and put it in every episode in the month of November.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see that email yet, but I'm going to definitely check that out after the show. And just a little clarification, I wasn't saying go out and use the word praxeology. I was saying make the praxeological argument.
So I don't know what that means. Yeah. What is it? Explain it to me. In real very terms, few yeah. words, like, you know, if you ran into me at the commissary and I had to run, but I'm like, yeah, okay, real quick, tell me what it is.
All right. Yeah. Praxeology basically states that you as a person make decisions that are going to be best for you. You might not even have to think about the action itself, but whatever you do, you did it because the second or third option wasn't going to make you better. At least you didn't perceive it as being better. And more importantly, in closing, is that you didn't do the second and third thing because the first thing that you did, the real action that you did, was actually what you perceived to be beneficial. So that we just kind of like when we want to go into trade with each other, we trade because we both have a perceived value of the trade, or we wouldn't trade in the first place, right? So if somebody forces us to do a trade, that's usually our second and third option that we didn't want to do, or we would have done a first option in alternative. So usually it's just saying that human action, we naturally have a want to improve our own lives when people are left alone.
Yeah,
I
understand that now. But for the average person, you lost me with your first two words when you said states that praxeology states that any definition that starts with states that 60% of the people listening just tuned you out and went, man, shut up, college boy. I mean, what you said to me basically sounds like it boils down to explain to people how doing what you want them to do will benefit them, or exactly. Or in even simpler terms, how does this help number one being me to most people? Is that correct?
Because you could be helping somebody else. Mother Teresa, when she did charity, she was helping out others, but she perceived a gain in her, maybe her heart.
Well, yeah, she was helping herself. I mean, I have a theory that there's no real altruism, but that sounds like a kind of nihilistic viewpoint, like, everyone just looks out for themselves. I think that in trade and every human interaction that's not violent is some form of trade. And I guess you could say that even violent interaction, aggression, governments making you do something is a trade. It's not free trade. It's not the free market, but it is someone making a value judgment on will this help me to do it or will it help me more to not do it? Like, you know, paying taxes or signing up for Obamacare. Like, for instance, I don't think either of those things are ethical. I do pay taxes because I don't want to get my door kicked in. So far, I've decided for now to not sign up for Obamacare because I don't think it's to my advantage to do it. There may come a time when it is. It may come in the next year, but those aren't really judgments based on morality. You know, I think that making me do either of those things is immoral, but I'm picking and choosing my battles, and I've chosen that signing up for Obamacare right now for me is a battle. I guess I'm willing to tab. I think it's more like so many people are not going to sign up for it. And actually, my insurance provider told me that the way the law is written, and they're not telling people this, and this comes from someone else, so I don't have proof on this, but I think that an insurance salesman would know this. She said that the penalty doesn't kick in as long as you buy it by December 31st, 2014. And an insurance person who would tell you anything you want to get a sale would tell you, oh, you have to buy it by January 1st. But she actually told me you have till the last day of the year to buy it to be legally. I think by then either the government's going to collapse under its own weight, or it'll be repealed, or they'll make everybody, they'll just do single payer where they just raise everyone's taxes and give everyone crappy health care. So.
But is that really a viable option? I mean, I know you don't support that, but what I'm saying is they have so much invested in this, at least from the political spectrum. I mean, all these people have been setting this up for years, these wheels in the background that have been moving, they're all in place. I can't see them wanting to change the structure even to a single-payer system because of all the lobbyist efforts that have gone into the back of it. I don't know. I don't know the future. This is all speculation to me.
I mean – I haven't studied it very much, and there's a lot more things on my mind that are a lot more in the forefront. Right. But what the, you know, right winger pundits, the Fox News types, the Rush Limbaugh types, and, you know, I don't agree with most of what they say, but I'm not going to dismiss them just because they're who they are. Cause, you know, a stop clock is right once or twice a day. And they're all basically saying that the initial idea was single payer healthcare, and that there's actually a soundbite of Obama when he's running for office the first time, where he's at some, you know, small gathering somewhere. He said that. He said, "Yeah, I want America to have a, you know, UK Canadian style healthcare system." Right. And all the right winger pundits are saying that basically the plan all along was for Obamacare to fail because they couldn't get the single. They tried to get the single payer thing through, and they didn't have the votes for it. And then they bullied congressmen. Who knows if the NSA had like secret pictures of people with, you know, underage kids, or if they had, you know, their secret offshore accounts where they're funneling bribes. Who knows how they did it? But somehow they got the votes. And did it with a non-single payer with the Obamacare thing, which all the pundits are basically saying that was designed to fail, and that even the website is designed to fail. Like all the problems people are having with it are intentional by design. And the hope is that by about June of this year, everyone will be screaming, just screeching, and believing they're going to, you know, get arrested if they don't buy it. And there'll be some kind of emergency thing where they'll just wave a magic wand, and all of a sudden the America will have a healthcare system like the UK, except worse, because in the UK, you've had decades of doctors going to medical school knowing they're not going to make a lot of money being doctors. You know, they make more money than they would digging a ditch. But doctors in the UK and Canada don't make shitloads of money like they do in America. But doctors in America can. So basically what's going to happen is this whole system is going to push older doctors to retire early. It's going to push younger doctors to go into systems that aren't in Obamacare, like, you know, they will just go be the private physician for some billionaire, that kind of thing, to where literally if you have a cold and need an aspirin, you're going to have to wait 2 days at a hospital, and everyone's just going to be screaming to the point where they say, yes, please double our taxes and give us single payer health care.
Yeah. And when you tell this, you know, to most people, of course, people don't see the incentive structure in the background of this. But they think that these like government workers are going to be working just as hard as another company that has to answer to you directly. Right. You know what I'm saying?
If you've ever been in the DMV or the post office, you know, know, that's not true.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And so, you know, I can see your point. I can see where people would say this was made to fail. I guess, in essence, they're always trying to make freedom fail on one level or another. I mean, it's not freedom's fault that's failing. They're going to try and taint it so they make a regulation or a mandate or some kind of a you know, restriction or some kind of a law to affect freedom. And then whatever happens out of that, they blame freedom instead of the regulation or the tax or whatever actually negative externality that came into this that screwed up everything, right? So it's such a mind yeah, anyway. So, you know, I love looking at the current system and dissecting it. We obviously have to point out where it's wrong, where it's unethical, where it's inefficient. But I'm one of those guys who's always trying to look for solutions to. You see me bitch about, you know, the government a lot. But I like to look at the solutions. And you're one of those do-it-yourself guys. So while I have you for the show today, I'd really, you know, maybe for the rest of the show, kind of focus on the do-it-yourself tasks.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite topics. I mean, the living I made before I became a libertarian was writing books and making movies, but basically writing. But the books I wrote were on how to do-it-yourself media and promote it. And so I could talk about that all day long without even mentioning liberty, but I tend to sneak liberty into it. But yeah, I don't just talk about liberty is what I'm saying. And I'd love to talk about DIY art and promotion.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here, one of the questions I had, I forgot to write down the person's name who asked me this. I have a bunch of viewer questions on here, but one of them was, what are some of the do-it-yourself tasks that people can do right now to improve their lives and reduce giving their time and labor and money to the state? You know, what's some agorist things that we could do and put in action, even a poor person who might not have much money?
Well, agorism, first of all, the idea of intentionally not licensing a business, not paying taxes on a business, and not doing any of the jumping through the hoops of the state. It's something that somebody came up with, some guy who was really into Dungeons and Dragons came up with in the 60s or 70s. And it's not a political system. It's not an ideology. It's a tactic. And you could be an agorist and not be an anarcho-capitalist. It's very popular in anarcho-capitalism, right, but you could be a socialist or even a communist and be an agorist. So I want to make it clear that agorism is just a tactic. It's not a political belief system. And a lot of people think it is their belief system. It's not a belief system. You could be an anarcho-capitalist without being an agorist, and you can be an agorist without being an anarcho-capitalist. I am an anarcho-capitalist who is not an agorist. I support the idea of it, but I pay taxes. I don't need to register a business because I don't really have a business where people come in from the street or anything like that. It's all done. I do a lot of different work for everything from major corporations to single individuals over the internet and over the phone and with fax and FedEx and mail, things like that. So I'm not an agorist, but I definitely have a lot of experience doing it yourself, building a personal business, and quitting your day job, basically. I wrote a book. You should probably link it when you put this up. I sent you the link to it. It's called A User's Manual for the Human Experience. And I wrote it. It's got a little bit of – it's kind of a libertarian self-help book on getting idiots out of your life. And the second part is on time management. And it's a very useful book. The liberty part of it is really kind of green. I wrote it when I was barely newly a libertarian. So the libertarian parts of it are just kind of like, oh, isn't that cute? It sounds like a newly minted libertarian. But the how to deal with idiots in your life and the time management part are incredibly solid, and they're based on 10 years of experience. Actually, more than that, 10 years of experience of not having a day job and, a lifetime of doing it yourself. Like I did do-it-yourself art from very early age. Like I published a newsletter on a Xerox machine at the library when I was 11 and handed it out at school. I was building radio transmitters when I was 12 and talking to the neighborhood on FM radio. And I played in a punk rock band when I was 19 and put out our own record and pressed 1,000 7-inch vinyls and didn't have money left over for the covers. So we like got a friend who worked at Kinko's to print them up in the middle of the night and then had a party and bought some cheap beer and had people come over and like fold the covers and then put them in a plastic baggie and then take a razor blade and cut the snap off the top of the baggie. And that's how we packaged our record. And, and I've done media in music, publishing books and radio and podcasting at all levels, like at the totally independent level, at the corporate level where someone's sending me a paycheck, and the in-between level, on all of them except podcasting. On podcasting, never really made a living at it, but had a good time with it and got really good at audio production and got good at making episodes and making things that work like radio, and then finally got on actual radio. So
yeah, no, good stuff. I love the do-it-yourself idea, but you still support like division of labor and specialization and all that, right?
Part yeah.
of the free market, obviously, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I do it myself with a lot of things, I mean, I often work with other people. I mean, I work with Nima. My wife does some of my proofreading of almost everything I write, and she does a lot of the voicing of our ads and demos and promos and things. The thing that really got me into DIY computer art was basically I got a computer in 1990 and got on the internet in 1996 and had my first website like 2 weeks after I got on the internet, like Thanksgiving 1996, my first website went up. It was kittyfeet.com, which is now the Anarchy Gumbo website. But I've had that that domain since 96. And basically, I was starting a band. It was back when I was still trying to start bands after my band, my Warner Brothers band Bomb, broke up. I started another band and then made a solo project, made a solo CD. And I wanted to make like a one-sheet promo press release. And I wanted a recent picture of me on it. And I hired a photographer because back then, like, digital photography wasn't common. I hired a photographer and she was incredibly flaky. And I was like, you know, a lot of people are really flaky. So and I'm not. When I say I'm going to be somewhere, I'm going to be there. And when I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And most people don't do that. And that's the biggest problem with DIY art. Like, a do-it-yourself business is not for it. You have to have some structure, like self-structure in your life. You know, people look at like working at home like, oh, great, you can work whenever you want to. Most people, if they can work whenever they want to, they don't, and they end up starving. You know, a lot of times when I'm yakking with someone on the phone, I'll say to them, this is something my dad used to say, like, well, I got to get off the phone, do some work, or I'm going to have to fire myself. And my dad used to say that jokingly, but it's literal. It's like if you don't have someone telling you to show up at work and you can't motivate yourself to show up at work, you won't work and you'll end up not making it in any way in the business you're trying to do. So there was this photographer who flaked on me in 96 and was like really difficult to work with. And I was paying her. So like I just went to the drugstore and bought one of those little disposable cameras. And like, literally, this is like way before Facebook or anything like that. Like I just held this, you know, as a film camera. It wasn't a digital camera. I just held it out with my arm, like people do with every picture on the internet, and took a picture of myself and used like an early version of Photoshop and cropped my arm out of it. Oh, I had to take it to someone who owned a scanner because scanners were rare and expensive and not everyone had it then. So I had someone scan this picture. It took them a week to do it for me, get around to doing it. And they put it on a 3.5-inch floppy disk. And I stuck that in my computer and edited it on Photoshop and used like Microsoft Word to lay it out with this bio and made a one sheet and then just Xeroxed them off. And it was like, I mean, this all kind of sounds like carving in stone tablets now, because everybody is walking around with the ability to film and edit a feature film on their phone in their pocket and on their iPhone and their iPad and their chromed robot turds. And I'm not saying like, back when I was your age, to use the internet, we had to walk both ways uphill in the snow. But it kind of was like that. And like, I mean, I'm talking about, I was doing music and putting out music in, you know, 1984, like on vinyl, and going to recording studios that didn't even have a computer in them, and recording on tape and paying, you know, working manual labor to save up money to pay an engineer in a studio $200 an hour, and like rehearsing really well so you could go in the studio and record and mix, you know, a 5-song EP in 8 hours and be out $1,600 and then need $1,200 to get the 1,000 records pressed and mailed to you. And then like packaging them up and mailing them out to radio stations, mailing physical copies out to radio, you know. And, you know, I'm getting into radio now, and it's like, we got syndicated recently and we're on a bunch of radio stations, and I'm sending, you know, basically calling every talk radio station in the country, like basically people that play Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, and saying like, hey, you should put our show on. We're anarchists, you know, and that's not really the pitch, but that's the pitch. If you listen to the, you know, if you listen to our show, which they do before they put us on, it's pretty tough. A lot of stations won't do it, but Ian Freeman from Free Talk Live has done the groundwork. Like he was the first and only basically ANCAP radio show, and he's done it for 10 years and they're on 120 stations. My show has done it for 6 months and we're on 11 stations. And Ian is blown away. Ian's like, it took me 3 years to get 11 stations. You know, part of it is the world has changed. Libertarianism is not only not a dirty word to a lot of conservatives. It's like, oh, that I know what that is. And I know there's an audience for it. Like when Ian started doing this, he had to explain to radio stations what libertarianism meant 10 years right. ago. You know,
it's kind of like being a Rothbard back in the day when there was no other libertarians there.
It's kind of like being a rock band back when I was in a rock band. Like now, I mean, literally, like we booked tours making phone calls when long distance phone calls cost money, calling from our home phone with phone numbers we got out of Maximum Rock and Roll magazine. And we're talking to people that, like, a lot of times they were like high school kids who were renting a bar out one night a week to put on punk rock shows. And whoever was doing the shows changed like every month or every few months. So you had to keep up on it. And we traded information with other shows, other bands and things like that. And kind of like we did it when it was really hard and there wasn't a network for it per se. And Ian has kind of built that network that I'm standing on the shoulders of him as a giant to be able to get 11 stations on commercial radio for an ANCAP show in 6 months. And it's interesting, though, like he and I exchanged phone numbers and contacts at one point and a lot of his notes from like, you know, 8 or 9 years ago say like, yes, sent a CD to this program director at this address. And I'm like, CD? You sent CDs? You sent audio CDs to people? And he's like, yeah, that's how I did it back then. Like most people weren't really on the internet. You couldn't just send them an MP3 link. And out of the like 1200 stations I've called, all of them that have said, yeah, send me a demo, you know, all of them except one has said, yeah, send me a link. One of them said, send me a CD. And I was like, really? I was kind of thinking like, what year is this, man? But I sent him a CD and he never called me back. So let's take a break. We're at 30 minutes here and we'll come back in a couple minutes.
You got it.
Cool, man.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, fights to protect your rights in the digital world. When a patent troll threatened podcasters, they fought back. EFF has also defended your right to encryption and has sued the NSA to end the government's mass, suspicionless surveillance. There are different ways you can help EFF, from donations, to signing petitions, to writing your representatives, to just spreading the word. Find out more at EFF.org. That's EFF.org.
Rolling.
All right. So here's my next question for you. I see some people inside of the freedom movement. They might have charges on them and they're going into the court system and they have two different choices that they can go with. They can either they'll be offered like a plea deal. Somebody will come up and say, hey, take this. You'll have less time, but you're basically admitting your guilt. But you're not going to have a threat of being in jail, you know, three times as long or something to that effect. And some people inside the freedom movement say, well, we should take those plea deals as often as possible. I guess to me, I see it being a threat to some individuals who obviously have bigger charges on them, who might be facing some really serious time, maybe even life. You know, if they're like 40 years old, they're facing 40 years. The plea deal is 10. They have 40 years that they're facing. Which one should they take? Well, some cases, if they tried to go the route of saying the laws don't apply to me and stuff like this, they'll find themselves really quickly in a cage. Now, on traffic tickets, smaller issues, obviously it's a great way to jam up the court system. You're not going to be facing jail time over a court ticket, right, or a driving ticket. But at the same time, I just see this need to get your opinion at least on what you think about taking plea deals and on bigger charges, on lesser charges. Go for it.
Hello, friends. This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. Do you know about Cell 411? Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone that you can get on the Google Play Store and the iPhone Store, wherever you beautiful people get your iPhone apps. Cell 411 allows you to send messages in real time, including video and audio if you want, to friends that you pick ahead of time and set up cells where you can help each other. Could be used for families to help kids not be bullied, so they can call an older sibling or a family friend if they're bullied. Basically, you set up a cell with your friends and family or whoever you want. There's a little wheel on it, and when there's an emergency, you just hit the button of like the appropriate thing, like car broke down,
police stop, criminal activity, I'm being pulled over, police interaction, medical emergency, fire, crime in progress, need a ride, ride sharing, anything. You can just call your friends and find them. It sends your GPS coordinates to them and gives turn-by-turn directions so they can get to you as quick as possible. They can also send a message back, yes, I'm coming, and it'll tell how many minutes away they are, or they can say, no, I can't come now. You can stream video and audio to them, which is stored on the Cell 411 servers for a few weeks. So if you get your phone taken away, you still have access to the video that was saved up until the point where your phone was taken away or destroyed. So if bullies, whether they're in uniform or private bullies, steal your phone, whether it's some Antifa or some overly helpful police person who doesn't want to be filmed doing his job for some reason, you'll still have access to this video. So I highly recommend that you get Cell 411. I use it. My wife and I use it. My friends and family use it. Cell 411. Go to getcell411.com or get it on the Google Play Store or iTunes Store. Cell 411, because your friends won't show up and shoot you.
It's a really complicated issue. I think there's a lot of bad information out there. I like the Never Take a Plea people. Is that Pete Ayer?
Oh, he's definitely one of them, yeah.
Okay. I like him a lot. I think we're actually interviewing him on The Fiends this weekend at some point about cop blocking in Africa. I like people who do it themselves on lesser charges, understanding the ramifications of it. I don't like when people give out information blanket stating that you should never take a plea and that you should use, you know, challenging people about their authority in court and things like that. My wife is a paralegal for a criminal defense attorney. And a lot of people who think, oh, well, this is what to do. If you can use these magic words on a judge or on a cop, you know, the only magic words are telling a cop I don't consent to a search, asking a cop if you're under arrest or detained, and asking for an attorney once you are arrested or detained. Those are really the only magic words. Anything beyond that, personally, I would hire an attorney for. There's also sort of a faction, I think, in the liberty community of some people who basically believe if you hire an attorney, you're being a statist, which is about the worst advice I've ever heard. I mean, if you are going into the belly of the beast, you want someone who speaks beast. And there's also people who say, well, maybe if you can afford an attorney, but you should never use one that's appointed for you. The thing about ones who are appointed for you, it's not necessarily a situation of they're looking out for the, you know, the court's best interest and they're going to screw you. And there's a really common misbelief that they're always newly minted attorneys who don't know what they're doing. That's not true at all, especially in the federal level. There are sometimes very experienced attorneys. The disadvantage of an attorney that's appointed for you versus one who you hire if you have the money is that the one that's appointed for you doesn't have much time to devote to you. And going into court is a lot more than the time the attorney spends in court. There's a lot of preparation. There's a lot that money can buy you as far as research and having other people on the case looking stuff up. Otherwise, the attorney's just going in with what he knows off the top of his head. And the law is so complicated and they add so much to the law every year that no one person, even a great attorney, can keep up with it all. They need a support staff to spend days and days and weeks combing over things and looking for things that can help. So I really don't like the BS of if you use an attorney or recommend people use an attorney, you're a statist. I really don't like the idea of never take a plea. Although the so-called justice system is largely based these days on pleas and it is playing into their hands. Another thing a good attorney can figure out a lot better than someone who just reads the law and doesn't have a lot of experience in courtrooms is being able to read the poker face of the prosecutor to know whether they've really got something or not, because they will, and I'm not giving legal advice. This is based just on my ancillary knowledge of knowing people who deal with the courts all day. But knowing whether the prosecutor has a case and is just trying to save time or doesn't have a case and is just trying to get a win. In state and local proceedings, it's fairly common for a prosecutor. It's more common for a prosecutor to try to get you to do a plea on something where he doesn't really have a case and thinks he's not going to have a great chance with a jury trial. That is not the case generally with federal prosecutors. Federal prosecutors generally don't take things to court if they don't if they don't have a slam dunk. Federal prosecutors have a really high conviction rate once they get to a jury. They will still bluff people and try to get them to take a plea when they don't have something, but sometimes if people don't take the plea, they'll let it go or they'll try to find something else to jack them up on. But state prosecutors, you know, even if they think there's a 50-50 chance they'll win with a jury, will sometimes, you know, they'll always try to offer a plea because they want convictions on their record. But a good attorney is going to know that prosecutor, know his history, and know the court and know the judge, you know about them and have a better idea whether you just walking in the door are going to have the idea of whether or not they're bluffing or not. You know, there's a saying, a good attorney knows the law, a great attorney knows the judge. And that predates liberty speech entirely. It's kind of an old Southern saying, but it's kind of true. And yeah, in that saying, in the old Southern saying, I think it means, you know, knows the judge and can go play golf with him and discuss it and work it out in the back room. But it also fits in the liberty sense of knows the judge, meaning knows his habits and knows what he does.
So what do you let's take this to the next step with the felonies and the federal prosecutors and all this. What do you think's going to happen to Adam Kokesh?
Oh, I don't even want to speculate, man. He's a good guy. I don't think he did anything that would be a crime in libertarian paradise, but we're not in libertarian paradise. And I think they want to make an example out of him. And me, I think I think they're going to try.
Yep.
I wonder if they'll offer him a plea or if they have. I don't know. I haven't really been following it. There's so much tyranny to keep up on that I can't keep up on all of it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but we've been doing shout outs to him on the show from time to time and, right, you know, wishing him well. And he did a shout out to us. He opened one of his from jail phone calls with hello, fellow liberty lovers and freedom fiends. And I don't know if he was talking to us directly or genericizing the name of our show, which is fine with me. I like the idea of freedom fiends as a generic term for anybody right into liberty. I'm fine with that. But yeah, I don't want to conjecture, man. It's a crystal. I don't have a crystal ball. You know, that's my answer.
Yeah. I don't think it's looking too good for him. I mean, we are once again inside the beast, right? So, I thought it was a perfect analogy you had earlier. Jay Haley wants me to ask you, what would it take for somebody to convince you that you're wrong about anarchy if they ever could?
Probably brain surgery. And I'm not kidding. I mean, you know, they could torture me and throw me in a cage for free speech or set me up on something. They could hold a gun to my head and make me say something that's contrary. You know, if I were tortured for weeks on end and they said, you know, sit in front of this camera and say that libertarianism is bullcrap, I'd probably do it. I don't imagine anybody would, even though they probably think I wouldn't turn in other people, but I kind of structure my life in a way that I don't know anything that's usable. And that's intentional. Like, I don't talk. If anybody starts talking to me about anything crazy, I delete them and block them and don't have anything to do with them. So like literally under torture, I would have no useful information that could incriminate anyone else. And I don't break any laws that I know of. I mean, they say everyone commits 3 felonies a day just by buying food at the market and driving their car and doesn't even know about it because the law is so complicated. But I don't do drugs. My guns are all legal. You know, pay my taxes. And I'm not saying that proudly. I'm saying that like, ugh, pay my taxes. You know, if I'm going to get thrown in a cage, it's going to be for talking like I'm talking now. They're going to have to change the law before they can throw me in a cage. So, yeah, I mean, I could be forced at gunpoint to appear on camera and say something against liberty. I think anybody could, but it wouldn't change what's in my head. I literally think it would take, you know, a lobotomy or brain surgery or cutting something out of my brain and drugging me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Plausible deniability with the torture. Huh? I love it. So, you know, we're looking at the, you just mentioned the lib pair, the libertarian paradise. You know, obviously, it's funny to give, you obviously don't believe that, like, libertarianism is a utopia, do you?
Oh, no. I think it would be a noisy, messy place, and especially at first.
Yeah. No, I agree with you at first until things
start. I think in lib pair, I think I'd be the guy, you know, the old man. If it happens in my lifetime, I'm probably going to be the old man with his cane in my front yard yelling, "You kids turn that down and get off my property." But, you know, I just won't call the cops on him. But yeah, I think it would be a messy, noisy place, especially at first. I mean, it's kind of like the analogy I've made is that statism and the government, all governments are like heroin addicts. They have to keep living beyond their means to sustain this unsustainable mindset and reality. And they'll do anything to keep from going into withdrawal, even if it means stealing. And if that all ended, everyone would go into withdrawal. I mean, it would be, there would be some chaos. There would be some mess. There would be some street violence, maybe a little more than there is now for a while, basically until all the thuggish animals shot each other, probably. And there would be some, you know, some old ladies who might starve for a week or something. But, that stuff all happens with government anyway. I'm sure that if that happened, all the statists would look and say, see, without the government, things are collapsing. But I think within a year or 18 months, the world would be there, or the whatever region that happened in would be a much nicer place to live. But I think it would still be noisy. I think it would still, I think people would still have loud parties. But, you know, I think everybody would also eventually have more property between them and other people, because the United States federal government owns like 2/3 to a half of the land in America, and you can't live on it. So, you know, I think I'd go claim 40 acres in Yellowstone and have a bunch of bison between me and my noisy neighbors, hopefully.
No, good stuff. So let's talk about a voluntary society. Do you ever see us ending the government down the road? And if, I know you don't have a crystal ball. I know you don't have a crystal ball. This is speculation, but I mean, we are just curious. Do you think we could ever reach a voluntary society? And is anywhere close, or is it like 1,000 years down the road? Which one would it be if either, you know, like, is it tomorrow, closer tomorrow, or going to be 10,000 years down the road? What would be your estimate?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I know.
That's my answer. That was my answer when I asked Scott Horton, when I interviewed him, who he's pretty much an ANCAP. I asked him, do you think Ron Paul's going to win and become president? And he said, wouldn't that be nice? You know, basically like, I can't see it happening, but wouldn't it be nice? I can see lib pair happening, but maybe not in my lifetime, maybe in 2 or 3 generations. I do believe, you know, I'm 50 years old almost. I'll be 50 this coming, you know, in about 6 months. I believe that if I, you know, my dad's 91, so if I don't get shot for free speech, I probably can live that long. So I think by my later years, you know, in 40 years when I'm a really old man, I think that America is going to be a vastly different place in one direction or the other, or maybe both directions at the same time. Like, I asked Cody Wilson, the printable gun guy, when we interviewed him.
Yeah.
And he said he basically sees government becoming less and less relevant to everybody, even to statists, to where it's like there's things that can be done that used to require the government to most people that can be done without the government. And most people just kind of live their life around it like it's, you know, like if you got a bum leg, you limp and you can still walk, you know, you work around it. He said that most people are going to it's going to become less and less relevant, interrupted by spectacular examples of the state just crushing individual people and trying to make examples out of them.
Yeah, you know, they have this new legislation that's going through talking about putting these little GPS trackers that are also going to be like installed in cars. And it'll tell how many miles the people go, and they're going to tax them on that. Kind of like a usage tax. I guess it would be like a libertarian society.
Alex Jones has been saying that for a while. And, you know, a lot of people think he's crazy, but he gets it right a lot, man. He's been saying on radio for 16 years, the government is spying on you and reading all your communications. And apparently with Edward Snowden's reveal, it's true, you know, and like all the mainstream media is saying it now. I just got an email from Anthony Bichard of the Wyoming Gun Owners Association, who said that the police in Cheyenne, Wyoming, are having a training event coming up soon here that is attempting to teach police in Wyoming to recognize and respond to racist militias. And they're basically lumping anybody who's a constitutionalist or a libertarian or a Ron Paul supporter or, you know, wants to homeschool their children Christian or anything that's not Obama-tastic, lump them in with, you know, hardcore violent racists. That's what he sent me he sent out to everybody the flyer for internal use for police for this. And it's like, you know, it basically says, if you like your gun rights, you're part of the KKK and need to be watched and searched and stopped. I mean, that's Wyoming, too, which is like a far more leave me alone kind of you can do what you want place than California or New York.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And, you know, when I was bringing up the car example with a little GPS, you know, I was just trying to show how the government's becoming extinct. Someday I think that's going to be how they do it in, you know, libertarian.
Well, I think that black box will be largely hacked. I think a lot of people will figure out workarounds for that. And also, you know, there's a lot of cars that don't have it that'll be around for 20 or 30 years. And I don't see them just outlawing them. They might try to do something like, you know, if you have an older car that doesn't have the gas mileage of the newer car with the box, that they tax you in some way. But they can't get everybody all the time, and they can't put in, you know, if they put in a thing of like, you know, you get 10 years in prison for driving an old car, that'll get challenged on, you know, Eighth Amendment issues, and that'll tie up the courts. And
they just need a cash for, they need cash for clunkers 2.0, man. You know, that's the answer.
No, they'll probably try that.
Yeah, I know, right? I shouldn't give them ideas.
Yeah.
So Bud Back East, he actually made a statement, and then he has a question. He says he listens to your podcast, and he understands where you guys are coming from with the guns, pot, and liberty in a broad sense. His question is, could a really large community, maybe even a city, be based on your way of thinking with the do-it-yourself mentality? You see where he's going with this?
The do-it-yourself mentality or the libertarian mentality? They can exist without each other.
Well, then in that case, let's combine the two of them. And could you have a libertarian society of a lot of do-it-yourselfers in a large community? Explain how that could work out.
Well, first of all, he mentioned pot and guns. I don't smoke pot. I've been sober for almost 20 years. I became a pot activist before I became a libertarian because my only child died of cancer in 2006. She was 24. My daughter Amelia died of cancer, and she was anti-drug. She was kind of a square, good kid, you know, straight A student, went to church, was involved in church. Not that you can't do some of those things in like pot, but you know, she was squeaky clean. And when she got cancer, a doctor recommended that she smoke pot to deal with the chemo, and she did. And it helped her. And it was like the only thing that gave her relief while dying of something really painful. And that she broke the law to do it. And the thought that someone could have thrown my sick, dying only child in jail for medicating for something that worked, just really made me adamantly pro legalization of pot, and not just pro medical pot, but pro legalization across the board before I was even a libertarian. I was anti-gun most of my life. I thought only the police and army should have guns. Although I was anti-army, I was anti-war and didn't like police much from just run-ins I'd had as a person. So I don't know why I didn't really think that through, but I became, you know, pro legalization of pot. And then a few years later, or, you know, around that time, not much longer after that, a year after that, became a gun owner. It was Boston Tea Party that really made me combine the idea of activism for both, because in his book, in his book, You and the Police, he basically talks about the wrongness of people outlawing drugs, but he doesn't use drugs. He's kind of square, and I say that in a respectful way. He's kind of like older gun owner. He doesn't hang around hippies. You know, he's not a pot smoker, and doesn't want to be around drug users. But he points out the fact that they use the war on drugs to get into your car, to search your car and then bust you for having a bullet or not registered gun or anything like that. And then I started thinking about the fact that I got involved in all these pro gun organizations, and the only one I'm still a member of is the Wyoming Gun Owners, Anthony Bouchard's thing, because all of the other ones, they don't take it far enough. The NRA, is pro war on guns. On drugs. I couldn't even wrap my head around that now, on supporting, a pro gun organization that's pro war on drugs. And they're very much like, obey the law and cooperate with law enforcement. And here's our profile on law enforcement. And it's like, we're just a couple years away from there being enough, brainwashed public school youngsters to get a 51% vote to outlaw guns. So how are all these honest gun owners going to feel who are I say I obey the law. I obey the law because I don't want to get thrown in jail. There's a lot of gun owners who are like, I obey the law because I'm an upstanding American, not like those drug addicts who smoke pot and break the law. I register my guns. I'm an upstanding citizen. What are they going to do when their guns become outlawed? How are they going to feel about their patriotic chest beating of support law enforcement when when those people who are kicking in doors of drug dealers now, when we find out that that was training for, when they legalized pot and those people still need a job and they just transfer them all over to kicking in doors, taking guns. That doesn't even answer your question, does it? Could there be a community? Well, I don't know. I think individualism is a great tool. And I don't mean that every man should be an island at all. You need people are social creatures. They need to have friends. They need to build communities around them. They need to engage in commerce and free trade of ideas and goods with people. I don't know any more that needs to be in a geographic location. I think with the internet and with communication and with radio, that can be done worldwide. And I think that trying to do it in a location irritates people. I mean, look at Free State New Hampshire, and I think it's a great thing, and I think it's great what they're doing. I'm not a part of it because I don't have the desire or the need to be around a bunch of people that are like-minded, and they're getting a lot of pushback, and that's not a reason to not do it. But individuals doing it networked across the world is another way to do it, or a way to combine with in-person. I guess I'm saying that it's really hard to find a geographic location, buy it, or move people into it, and have your own have your idea be the predominant idea in it. I mean, it's happened throughout history with nations conquering other nations, Mormons moving to Utah, racists have tried doing it in Idaho, and now there's one guy trying to do it in North Dakota. He's basically got there's a racist guy in North Dakota who's got three other racists living on his property, and he's inviting other racists to move there. It's a town of 12 people, and he's trying to move 13 people there and then take over the government. And the city is responding by basically they're thinking of dissolving the city into the county so it can't be done.
Wow.
If you have an idea, and that's a horrible idea. Racism is a horrible idea. But if you have a good idea, right, like Liberty, trying to move it into a place. I mean, there's the Free State Wyoming project. It doesn't have the numbers that the Free State New Hampshire one does, but it has about a third as many people in a state that has about a third as many population as New Hampshire. So really, Free State Wyoming has the same percentage of residents are members of the Free State project in that state as in New Hampshire, but they're not really public about it. They're kind of like leave me alone people. They're not people, if you went to Pork Fest in New Hampshire and took out a video camera and started filming people, 10 other people with cameras would come over and say, oh, what kind of camera do you have? I have this kind of camera, and be discussing it. If you pulled out a camera at a Free State Wyoming project, you know, five people probably come over and say, who are you and why are you filming us? Which isn't a bad thing, but it's kind of a difference between the two ideologies.
Right.
It's, you know, I mean, they do a lot. If they're on the internet, it's not on Facebook. It's like communicating in encrypted group emails. And I'm not even privy to that. I'm not a member of Free State Wyoming. I have friends who are, but I never pledged. So those are two examples of, you know, migration movements. There was one in Europe, I think it was in Denmark or maybe the Netherlands. It's called Christiana. It was the name of a former town army base, and basically a bunch of squatters took it over. And the government let them, like, they basically didn't throw them out. So that involved like permission from the government, or at least looking the other way. And it was literally like a gated squatter community. I mean, there was a fence around it because it was a former military base and it had a bunch of housing in it for military. And a bunch of hippies took it over and basically turned it into a pot economy place in a country where pot was illegal and we're left alone. Now, it went pretty well for a long time, but then at one point, a bunch of violent bikers with chains and knives went in there and tried to rough them up and steal the weed and steal their women and stuff like that. Steal their women and just raised hell. And, you know, the peaceful pothead anarchist had to call the police to get someone in to deal with it. So I think that single issue places are a bad idea. And I also think that guns can protect pot. So if people want to have a pot place, they should probably also be gun people in Europe or wherever they can get away with it. Although if you try to do that here, I mean, they've already preempted that. Like, the Department of Justice issued a statement last year saying that if you are a medical marijuana user, you know, sheriffs should not issue concealed carry permit holder permits. And I literally think that that is a reaction to the press that our movie Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom got, because that's gotten a lot of views on YouTube. It's gotten a crap load of downloads on BitTorrent. It's reshared a bunch of places and we sold a bunch of copies of it. I would be surprised if someone at the Department of Justice didn't get a hold of a copy of that. And about a year and a half after that movie came out, the Department of Justice issued a statement to all sheriffs nationwide. I think it was sheriffs, somebody who's, you know, who's, or the people who were like, maybe it was state police who were supposed to tell the sheriffs, but it was kind of a top down thing of like, you know, don't issue concealed carry permits to people who are medical marijuana card holders. So it's really hard to build a, you know, let's buy some land and have our paradise, because your paradise is surrounded by, you know, local governments, local citizens who won't like you, state governments, you know, local governments, local citizens, local governments, county governments, state governments, and federal governments. I mean, you have your little island of whatever liberty you want in there, whether it's gun liberty, weed liberty, all liberty, gay marriage liberty, racist liberty, you know, Mormon liberty, whatever it is. I mean, the Mormons did battle with the federal government and were shot and killed by the federal government. Right. And basically the compromise they made was, we're only going to have one wife each. You know, they compromised their initial idea to blend in more in America. So I think it's really hard to create a community like that, where you have a central location and try to build your own government or lack of government when you're an island surrounded by a bunch of governments. And there's people who are trying to do it literally on islands or literally on boats or on tankers or whatever. But, you know, then you're going to have air forces, or, you know, navies coming after you of various government. You're going to have the UN coming after you. I mean, I really think my better idea is to just be a free person as much as I can be without going to prison, in my own home and out in the world, walking around the world and talking to the world over the internet and over the radio, and having community through a few friends in my area and, you know, who aren't even all libertarians, but I'm kind of working on them. And some of them are, and some of them are gun people and some of them are, you know, ANCAPs, and just trying to spread a good message by example to people. I think, I mean, I guess this goes back to your question of, do you think there will be LibPair in my lifetime? The analogy I like to use, and I think this initially, this probably goes back to like Mises or somebody, but Stefan Molyneux is really fond of saying it, of like, you know, comparing the state to slavery in America in the 1800s. And it's like, anybody who says, well, let's, you know, we can't get rid of the state, who would take care of the roads? You know, that's like saying we can't free the slaves, who would pick the cotton, is the right Stefan Molyneux line. And it goes back to like, you know, the first time anybody looked at what liberty is, they called the opposite of liberty the state, you know, slavery of some form. It's an old idea. But he says it really well with the who would pick the cotton. And I kind of feel like, you know, you, Michael Shanklin, me, Michael Dean, Nima Vidati, Stefan Molyneux, Free Talk Live, all these people, you know, Stephanie Murphy, all these people doing media now. And it's kind of exploding, too. Like, I do a blog called creamyradioaudio.com that has tips on how to do audio and how to do radio stuff cheaply and well. And we have Amazon links on the stuff on there. And it's been exploding lately of the number of audio production items that people have been ordering just through my Amazon affiliate link. Like, I can't see who's ordering them, but I can see what's been ordered. And it's like every week, you know, people clicking through my link are buying like two mixers and five microphones and a bunch of cables, like every week. You know, there's a thing that they said, that Lou Reed said, that I really dug, was that Lou Reed, who recently died and was a guy I really looked up to, and he's in one of my movies. Lou Reed said his old band, The Velvet Underground, like the first 10 years that record came out, it only sold like 30,000 copies. And that's nothing on a major label. And he said, yeah, that record only sold 30,000 copies, but everyone who bought a copy started a band. And that's kind of what I want the Freedom Fiends to be. Like, you know, we're not as popular as some other things out there, but a lot of people that listen to us, we tell you, not only you can do it yourself, but we have resources that we've written that tell you how to do it. And a lot of people who listen to the Freedom Fiends are starting their own podcasts and eventually starting radio shows. And I feel that's as important, if not more important, than what I'm doing with the Freedom Fiends. And I guess the thing when I think about like, can, you know, will we have liberty in my lifetime? I think about, if I were somebody in 1840 who was adamantly anti-slavery and, you know, publishing pamphlets and trying to give speeches, there were people who did that then and nobody listened to them. Like 1% of the population was like, okay, that makes sense. But it was dangerous to even say that kind of stuff. Like, it's becoming more dangerous now to say the kind of stuff we're saying. It was dangerous to say it, but people felt in their core of their being so strongly that it had to be said, that they said it anyway, even though they could get thrown in jail, they could get beat up. People did get thrown in jail. People did get beat up. People got killed for saying that kind of stuff. But they said it anyway. And they also said it even though, you know, in 1820, it looked like there would never be an end to slavery in America. It looked impossible. But there were people who devoted their life to yelling at it. And it's like, those people yelling loudly about it in 1820 led to in 1864 or 65, whenever, when slavery ended, it led to that. It built. And we're not the first adopters of liberty. I mean, people have been talking about liberty forever, but it's fairly recent that people have taken it to anarcho-capitalism. Because, I mean, if you listen, there's some recordings on YouTube of some like libertarian guy that was doing a shortwave radio show like 20 years ago, and somebody had like a reel-to-reel tape recording of it and put it up on the internet. And it's like, he's saying a lot of the same stuff we're saying, but he also starts his show with "Greetings, fellow patriots." And it's like, you know, so he still has an idea of the state in his mind. You know, patriots who are kind of libertarian leaning are usually people who think, well, the government was good back in the day, but it's been taken over by these communists and we have to go back to when it was good. And it was like, it was really never good. Like, the Constitution set up bad things and was violated by the people who signed it within a few years of it being signed. You know, George Washington with the Whiskey Rebellion, you know, he was violating the Constitution that he signed. And so you can't really go back to that America, because it's an America of the mind. It never really was. You know, it's like, what do you want to go back to? Do you want to go back to, you know, separate but equal, you know, do you want to go back to like separate but equal segregation water fountains, which is a horrible idea? Or do you want to go back to like cholera and dysentery? You know, which America do you want to go back to? I think we should look forward and not in the Obama sense of forward in the march to socialism, but in forward into like, we don't even know what this thing's going to look like. We can't centrally plan it. It's really impossible to answer the questions of who would build the roads. There's people who do a better job of it than me. But my main thing is just yelling at and laughing at the tyranny and educating as many people as possible about it and giving them the resource to go out and start their own thing. Because I'm not going to be around forever. You know, I want a bunch of people doing Liberty podcasts who wouldn't be otherwise, you know, after I retire or get droned or get gitmoed or die of old age or just decide I don't want to do this anymore. You know, that could happen. So I want to encourage other people to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Michael, it's been amazing to have you on the show. I got one last question for you before I let you go.
All right.
I always ask everybody this the first time they come on my show right at the end. If you were on your deathbed and you had 1 or 2 minutes, ABC, Fox News, CBS, or CNN, they all come running up to you. Not that that matters. But let's just say that everybody in the world is going to hear you for 1 or 2 minutes. What would you say to the world?
People have asked me that before, and I've thought about it, and I don't really think I would have anything to say to the world, because I think I've already said it over and over and over for decades, and especially for the past few years. I mean, I guess what I'd say is go listen to the three. If I were to die today and someone stuck a microphone in my face as I was dying, I'd probably say, get that fucking microphone out of my face and get out of my house. I want to hold my wife's hand while I die and be around my kitty cats. You know, I don't have a need to have a pithy last word on record. And I say it daily. You know, I mean, there are nearly 300 episodes of Freedom Fiends Up. There's movies I've made. There's books I've written. They're all out in the world. They're all on BitTorrent, too. Like, they couldn't be stopped by droning me and my website. So I would say I don't have a last word. This sounds kind of cheesy, but it's kind of true. I live every day like it's my last, and I try to do every episode that I do of radio or media, every piece of media, I try to do it like it's not only the last thing I'll ever do, but like it's the only thing that will ever be heard by me.
Well, good stuff. Well, let's hope this isn't your last interview. I hope you have many years to come.
Thanks, man. You too.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for being on the Triple V. And as you know, I'm going to have you back on hopefully within the next 3 weeks, or excuse me, 3 months, and we could go into a whole nother niche of questions. This has been really entertaining. I appreciate it.
Worms.
Yeah, I'll talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone, for checking out Triple V. As you guys know, I have a new show coming out every single day. Please check back over here, voluntaryvirtues.com, or you can go to YouTube, voluntaryvirtues0.com is the YouTube user handle. And we will always be here for your questions and answers. So thank you guys so much for your time, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.